I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. John Meacham says that if you think this is the worst, most divisive, most dangerous, most angry, and worrisome period in our nation's history, then you don't know American history. His new book, The Soul of America, looks largely at the period between Reconstruction and LBJ when we were at each other's throats. He traces the rise of Jim Crow and the KKK, the suffrage movement, the backlash against immigrants, the civil rights movement, war and isolation, and the Red Scare, and how different presidents dealt with those challenges and the power and limitations of the office. It's also about the activists and dreamers and visionaries who pushed the country and its leaders forward. John Meacham writes that the protests in Charlottesville last summer and the president's response got him thinking about the country's soul. John Meacham is a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer. He's also a visiting professor at Vanderbilt University, a contributing writer for the New York Times Book Review, and a fellow of the Society of American Historians. John Meacham, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm also the vice mayor of Munchkin Land. It's a lot of titles.
I wasn't sure whether to include that or not. All right. We have had presidents who are flawed, who have told lies, who have withheld information from us. They've been impeached. They've resigned from office. Yeah. Some were incompetent. Some made egregious mistakes. Some had mistresses. They all complained bitterly about the press. Many had corrupt, questionable cabinet members. How do you see President Trump stacked up against all our presidents?
The incumbent, and I try to change like Voldemort, I don't have to say the name much. The incumbent is the most vivid manifestation of many of our worst instincts. And those instincts are as much a part of the American soul as our brighter and better ones. I think that if we act as though the 45th president is somehow entirely new, two things result from that. One is we commit the sin of the narcissism of the present.
And, our own narcissism.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God! It's never been worse. Well, until three years ago, gay Americans couldn't marry. 55 years ago, in my native region, we lived under apartheid in the South, and women have not yet voted for 100 years in the country. And an entire race of people was enslaved for the life of the country, and that institution was enshrined in the Constitution, written not far from where we sit. So let's take a deep breath. My message is not we've been through it before, so we're going to get through it. My message is we've been through it before, so let's figure out how and apply those lessons now. My sense of the soul of the country is that it is capable of producing a Dr. King. It is also capable of producing a Ku Klux Klan. And every era is defined by the extent to which the better angels went out over the worst instincts.
What, though, explains this sort of swing between our democratic impulses and our undemocratic impulses, if I can look at it that way? And certainly when you look at this sweep of history, we see the sort of toggling back and forth between these parts of ourselves.
We go from guardrail to guardrail, and hopefully we end up in the right place. I think what explains it is that we're human beings. And the framers understood – I'm not trying to sentimentalize the founders as the apostles or anything, but – the Constitution is, in fact, a human document. It's a Calvinistic document, really. It takes account of our sinfulness, of our appetite, and our ambition. It assumes we're going to screw things up. And so, therefore, it tried to set up a system that would check one set of appetites from being able to take over the whole country. So in an experiment in self-government over this expanse of territory, this number of people – It was inevitable in a fallen world that you would have moments of darkness, because we are in fact creatures driven by our own interests. It's kind of remarkable when you think about it that we have managed to more fully interpret and apply the Jeffersonian assertion of human equality.
In spite of ourselves or
In spite of ourselves. And what we have to do, and I believe this as firmly as I believe anything, is the reason I wanted to make this argument is that I want particularly people who are inclined to be for the incumbent, I want them to look through the aperture of history and see the fact, not the partisan interpretation, but the fact that the nation has always grown stronger the more widely we've opened our arms. And when we have pointed at the other, when we have demonized immigrants, when we've demonized people of color, when we've excluded women, we have not been as strong. And so it is in fact in our self-interest, speaking as a white male, boring heterosexual as I am, to try to more generously interpret that assertion, the assertion of equality, because our history over 242 years tells us that we are better off altogether the more open we are.
Quoting you there, but is that because you have this cautious optimism because you are a white, boring heterosexual?
Well, you can't separate the two, so it's actually an unanswerable question. Perhaps
With the kind of privileges that come with that.
Sure, absolutely. I'm a Southern white man, so this is an argument. You can take it or leave it. But I've spent, because I was a weird child, I've spent 40 years or so thinking about these things and trying to encounter the American past and try to figure out what the past can tell us about where we are now and where we're going. And this one boring heterosexual's, since we seem to be focused on that.
momentarily.
Yes,
we will move on.
Yes. This white male's view is that our history tells us that the more people we accept into the mainstream who are not like me, the better off everyone is.
Do you think, though, there are, you know, similar countries to us? Look at Europe. Do you think there's something uniquely American about this struggle that we have with our various impulses?
It's not,
and values?
Yeah, the global argument's interesting. I don't think so, honestly. I mean, perhaps in an intellectual way, but as a practical matter, our political and cultural task is how do we make our daily lives as full and free and coherent, and how do we create opportunity? No country's ever created as much opportunity as we have in the history of the world for a variety of reasons. Geography, we have a lot of space. The idea that, as Lincoln said, we all have the right to rise, that the fight to save the Union, he said, to the 166th Ohio Regiment in 1864 was that we may all have a fair chance for our enterprise to lead us to prosperity and happiness. And my own sense is that, as Frederick Douglass said, really amazing figure, Douglass, I recommend, if people haven't read it, they should go and just read his lecture on Lincoln, delivered 11 years after the assassination at the unveiling of the Freedmen's Monument in Washington, where he talks about Lincoln. It's the most – I teach this in my classes. It's the most profound meditation on the tragedy of history I've ever read, because basically he says Lincoln was not the white – not our president. He was preeminently the white man's president. But and that's the key word in American history is but. Yes, but. But he freed people, and we have to honor that. So Douglass said that there is no soil as ripe for the growth of reform as American soil. And if a man born a slave in the middle of the 19th century had that insight, I think we should pay attention to it.
Which raises a number of issues, and it's interesting to think of Lincoln without Douglass, or Lyndon Johnson without Martin Luther King. I mean, your book is about how presidents and our leaders have grappled with this, but it's about those people who defied the status quo and wanted to push, you know, would not accept the status quo and push the country forward.
Here's a point of hope for your listeners who have already, you know, set their hair on fire once today and are planning for a long weekend of it. Politicians are far more often mirrors of who we are than they are molders. And so Lyndon Johnson is a remarkably courageous figure. And I understand about Vietnam. My father fought in Vietnam, never really recovered from it. I stipulate all that. But he finished the work of Lincoln. But he couldn't have finished the work of Lincoln without Rosa Parks and John Lewis and Martin Luther King and people whose names we do not know, countless people who stood up and said, Jefferson meant us too. And that created a climate that Johnson was able to masterfully and courageously push at a time when political interests would have led him to hold off. Johnson said wonderfully when he was being urged to wait on the 64 Act, he said, well, what the hell's the presidency for? if not to do the big things.
Voting rights.
Yeah, that other men might not. Suffrage. If you want a model of how social change happens in the United States, study the women's suffrage movement. Alice Paul had this – she went to England, learned the tactics there. There were terrible force feedings. It's deeply uncomfortable to read about how they would imprison the demonstrators, force feed them because they were on a kind of starvation strike. She decides that the best way to change the country and to extend this franchise is simply take the fight to the White House. Mm-hmm. So she took a house on Lafayette Square, and she and her colleagues would stand at the White House gates for 24 hours a day. And so Woodrow Wilson had to see them when it came and went from the White House. And it was, as the historian Gene Baker pointed out, it was the first time that a civil rights campaign had personally targeted the president. And the amendment resulted.
Fast forward to, 2017, after President Trump moves into the White House, and you have this enormous protest, largely of women across the country, in protest against that president and some of the things that he stood for and said. Do you think it has that kind of protest has the same kind of impact today?
I think we don't know until we know.
Until historians tell us?
Yeah. In a way, when you're in the middle of something, we all know this in our own lives. When you're in the middle, there's a wonderful line. Wasn't Elizabeth Bennet in Pride and Prejudice? She's talking to Darcy after they finally agreed to marry. And he says, how did you know? When did you know? And she said, I don't know. I was in the middle of it before I had known I had begun.
Oh, beautiful.
I think that's where a lot of social change, a lot of political change is. But absolutely, the lesson is, if you have marched against the president, if you are planning on voting in the midterm, if you are relentless on social media, keep doing it, because it takes a long time. It's I'm not saying that in a reassuring way. That's just a fact. People say on the gay rights agenda, they say, oh my God, you know, things have never moved so quickly. I've never heard a single gay person say, oh boy, this really moved fast. Right? So if you're not affected by it, it seems to move. Maybe that's moving quickly. But the work of the country has been toward, as Martin Luther King said, picking up a line from Theodore Parker, you know, the arc of a moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Is it inevitable that it bends toward justice? No. There's nothing inevitable. But our quarter of a millennia bit of history says that if our dispositions of heart and mind are in the right place, then things will be better than they were yesterday.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's John Meacham, our guest on Radio Times today, a biographer, historian, author of a new book called The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. 1-888-477-9499, radiotimes@whyy.org. Stay with us. Much more. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with historian and biographer John Meacham. He's got a new book, The Soul of America. It's about how the country has weathered crises, divisions in the past, and how we may be able to do that in the future as well. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. But it seems in these moments of serious crisis, it is a test for institutions, whether it's the judiciary, the court systems, or Congress itself, or the press, or other kinds of institutions. And it seems to me that is one of the tests that we have today, which is, will our institutions help us address some of the crises that we're dealing with today? And I don't know what the answer to that.
Well, I think the early returns are so far so good, cautiously. There are, I think, five elements in the Republican contract, lowercase r. There's the presidency, the Congress, the courts, the press, and the people. And the courts, by and large, have been, I think, a force for good in this. They've stopped the worst parts of the immigration orders. Congress is, you know, has put itself in witness protection.
Meaning they're not doing they're not talking.
No, and nobody. I think the polling now shows that they're actually below the margin of error on approval. There are more people who disagree, who hate Congress than are in the country.
Of course, they love their own representative.
Right, right. Although after that hearing yesterday, I wonder if that's if even that's the case. My own view, and I know enough of these folks. I believe they're going to throw themselves in front of the train. It's just going to be at the very last minute. And what many Republican senators have decided is there's not enough percentage in going to the floor every time he does something outrageous, but to keep their powder dry. And you can argue with that, and I do argue with that, but it's not an irrational decision to handle things that way. And if the House flips, and it's not impossible for the Senate to flip. In Tennessee, we have a fascinating Senate race that could be a gain for the Democrats. And so, but that's what we're supposed to do, right? Hmm. I mean, this is the undertaking, and we're supposed to organize. We're supposed to protest. We're supposed to say, as President Bush said, Senior Bush, in a different context, this will not stand.
Hmm. You write a bit about Senator Joe McCarthy, the Red Scare of the 1950s, the Army McCarthy hearings, where people were accused of being communists. Some of them were, some of them weren't. But there was a famous Edward R. Murrow, who was the journalist at the time, broadcast. This was March 1954. And I just want to play a portion of it, and then we'll talk about it. Let's listen.
No one familiar with the history of his country can deny that congressional committees are useful. It is necessary to investigate before legislating. But the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and the junior senator from Wisconsin has stepped over it repeatedly. His primary achievement has been in confusing the public mind as between the internal and the external threats of communism. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine and remember that we are not descended from fearful men.
That's just an extraordinary piece of journalism there in many
ways. It's witness, really. It's witness to the best parts of America in real time, early 54. McCarthy gets started on Lincoln's birthday in 50, gives the speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, says, I have in my hand the names of 205 communists in the State Department. There were communists in the State Department, but they were mostly gone by then because Harry Truman had taken care of it. Roy Cohn, later Donald Trump's lawyer, says that reflected that McCarthy bought anti-communism the way other people might buy a car. And that's
the kind of salesmanship.
Yes. And so let's think – just take 30 seconds here and think about this. So here's a political figure who was looking for a vehicle. He understood modern media. He was a kind of freelance demagogue, interested mostly in himself and his own power. And he brightly captured the attention of the country. That sounds somewhat familiar, doesn't it? And hired Roy Cohn, as did the future 45th president of the United States.
In fact, you quote from Roy Cohn's memoir. This is a piece you had in the New York Times, December 29th, 2017, and I'll just quote what you quoted. This is Roy Cohn talking about McCarthy. I was fully aware of McCarthy's faults, which were neither few nor minor. He was impatient, overly aggressive, overly dramatic. He acted on impulse. He tended to sensationalize the evidence he had in order to draw attention to the rock-bottom seriousness of the situation. He would neglect to do important homework and consequently would, on occasion, make changeable statements. So you're quoting Roy Cohn at the end of 2017 with a message for our president.
Absolutely.
And maybe the country as well.
Absolutely. And now the counter to this argument is McCarthy never became president, and that's true.
Right.
And this is as if Joe McCarthy or George Wallace had become president. I mean, that's the
You're
moment.
You're saying the current president.
Yeah, yeah. And in 1968, 50 years ago, George Wallace got 13.5% of the vote, carried five states. This is as though he had won. And so it is different. It's a different scale. But the underlying factors are similar enough that I think we can learn from this. McCarthy fell not least because our patience wore out. And this is not me. This is Roy Cohn talking. FDR once said, there's something in the human psychology that can't stand the constant repetition of the highest note in the scale. And my own view is that when the fever breaks, it's going to not least be because people could not stay attuned to this level of self-involved drama on the part of the person at the center of our politics.
People just get
– we're done.
Well, they'll tire of the drama?
Yes, because it's all self-created, most of it self-created. And we're also locked in a kind of long-term abusive relationship, really, because it's diabolical in its way because we can't – here's a double negative – we can't not respond. So the president of the United States tweets out some false statement, says something false, which he does it like 9 times a day, and that's just what we know about. And so you have to call that out. But then you call it out and he gets mad because he hears it's being called out, so he responds again. And so we're locked in this kind of tragic dance with him. But there's really no alternative because you have to, as Murrow did, you have to continue to bear witness. You have to continue to say no. And it's exhausting. It's wearying. It's dispiriting. But it's essential.
That's John Meacham, our guest on Radio Times today. He's a historian, a biographer, talking about a bit about our history and also talking about our current president. He's got a new book called The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. 1-888-477-9499. Got a bunch of comments here, which I do want to read. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, a tweet wondering whether you could comment on the similarities between President Trump and President Jackson.
Oh,
you wrote a book about.
I did. As Lloyd Benson said, you know, I knew Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson was a friend of mine, and I don't think Donald Trump, you are Andrew Jackson. Jackson was a populist figure. He was the first president of his kind. He was the 7th president. The first 6 had either been an Adams from Massachusetts or a Virginia planter. But Jackson understood that we were, as he put it, one great family in the country for all of his horrible transgressions against the American creed. He was a vital figure in expanding the franchise and expanding the idea that we were as much a democratic republic as we were a republic. And let me tell you a quick story.
Sure.
So in March of 2017, it was Jackson's 250th birthday. I'm sure you had a special show about it. Donald Trump decides to come down to Nashville, to the Hermitage where I live, to Jackson's house, and lay a wreath at the grave. And when presidents talk about their predecessors, it's always revealing because they see as they wish to be seen. And so clearly Trump was trying to grab the Jackson mantle. Steve Bannon, or the man I now refer to as the late Steve Bannon, had introduced this analogy and the portraits in the Oval Office and all that. So he's coming down to Nashville and I'm sitting at home thinking I should do something. So I wrote an open letter to the president saying that if you're going to embrace Jackson, don't just embrace the crazy parts, you know. And Jackson once said that his only 2 regrets in public life were that he had not hung Henry Clay and shot John C. Calhoun. Calhoun was his own vice president. We now know that no one felt that way about their running mate until John McCain. So that's good. So I write this saying, you know, Jackson was a figure of union. He was a good negotiator. And it ran in the local newspaper and it had no effect whatever, of course. But the next day I'm walking into lunch and my phone rings and it's my most recent subject. It was George H.W. Bush. So this is a true story. And he was calling, so I answer, of course. And he says, how you doing? The key to doing President Bush's voice, by the way, as Dana Carvey once said, is Mr. Rogers trying to be John Wayne.
He
says, how you doing?
How you doing?
And I said, I'm fine, Mr. President. How are you? He said, I'm fine. He said, I read your letter to Jackson. I thought, ooh, you know, the old boy's losing it, right? And he thinks I'm writing letters to dead people. So I said, Mr. President, thank you. But, you know, actually it was a letter to Trump about Jackson. And without missing a beat, the old man said, yeah, but Jackson will pay more attention.
Oh, gosh.
So that's kind of where we are. Right. So I don't think it's an interesting analogy. I think the more interesting analogy is Andrew Johnson, who was a
after the Civil War.
Yeah, white supremacist president, tried to undo the work of the verdict of the Civil War, was impeached, was not convicted by a single vote, was temperamental, had kind of a deep state conspiracy mind. So I think we have to go there for the best analogy.
Do you think a President Obama led us to a President Trump?
I wouldn't phrase it that way exactly, because that sounds as though there's some agency on Obama's part. I think that there is something
– Not how I intended.
I know.
I mean sort of how the country was reacting to two very different men.
I absolutely understand. I think that my view is that, yes, President Obama embodies the demographic destiny of the country. And I promise you this. In 20 years, we're going to look a lot more like Barack Obama's America than Donald Trump's. And my own view of this, I think I make this point in the book, is that the virulence of the backlash of this particular moment, of this particular presidential election, in a way validates the general trend. I think it's the last stand of a more demographically
mixed.
I'm losing.
As opposed to one.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Sorry, I'm losing my words here. Not enough coffee. In which the country is changing rapidly. President Obama was an embodiment of that. I believe that we will bounce back in the way we do. I mean, imagine this. Can you imagine five, six more different people than George Herbert Walker Bush to Bill Clinton, war hero to baby boomer to another kind of baby boomer, George W. I didn't think we'd live and see as stark a handoff as from George W. Bush to Barack Obama temperamentally until 2017, which means if that pattern holds, we may get Aristotle next.
We'd have to dig him up.
Live in hope.
We will dig him up. Let me read an email from Karen wondering whether you think there would be a quote-unquote Me Too movement if Hillary was president.
Great question.
Yeah.
Don't know, but I know this. It would not be as widespread and as passionate.
Also, another question. Isn't it different time now because of the internet / Twitter and more partisan news organizations? Or if I can add to that, or a more sort of segregated audience for news organizations.
Yeah. I have a counter view of this. That is true compared to, say, the politics of 1980, for instance. Although if we'd been sitting here in 1981, a lot of your listeners would be terrified that Ronald Reagan was going to starve the poor and nuke Russia before lunch, right? Reagan himself said, they think I'm a combination of the Mad Bomber and Ebenezer Scrooge. Mm. And but in the 18th century, 19th century, into the earlier 20th century, we were just as divided in terms of media consumption. All papers were partisan. Radio began to nationalize it. Television began to nationalize it. But as you know well, the Fairness Doctrine was repealed in 1986. Mm. Used to be you had to give both sides. Mm. 86, the Fairness Doctrine goes away. Rush Limbaugh is big by 88. He's so big by 92 that his support for Bat Buchanan puts Buchanan almost in the victory slot in New Hampshire. So in 96 is Fox. And so where we are now, interestingly and tellingly, is I think the media landscape is more like the 1850s than it ever has been since then.
I don't know what that means.
Because all newspapers were partisan. So if you were a merchant in Philadelphia, you probably subscribed to a couple of papers that had a particular partisan disposition. If you were a planter in Nashville, you did that. And do you think that Philadelphia merchants or planters in Nashville talk to a lot of different people? I don't think so. I mean, maybe they went to a coffee house and all that. But I think that we have been tribal forever. It just feels that I think I'm right about this is now it feels particularly sulfurous because it's so immediate. To go to the comment, because it comes in on your phone, because it's so close to you. I think there's a
literally on your body.
Yeah,
in many
ways. It's next to your heart. If you put it in your, if you're a man, you put it in your suit coat. So it's all right there, and it takes an extraordinary act of will to say, you know what, this too shall pass.
Almost, I'm going to break here. I just wanted to pick up something briefly. You mentioned LBJ. You also write about a Harry Truman in this book.
Yeah.
These were Southern men,
yeah.
I think racist for much of their life, used the N-word, said things
yep.
that were that we would find and should find really offensive probably mm-hmm. today and hopefully back then.
Yep.
But nonetheless, when it came to being president, when it came to policies, something changed.
They saw their duty whole, and it's not a sentimental point. Harry Truman, half his family were Confederates. He had an aunt who, great aunt, I think, he invited to the White House, and she said she'd come, but if he put her in the Lincoln bedroom, she'd leave because she hated Lincoln. Truman becomes president on April 12, 1945. You would not have bet a nickel that he would have integrated the military, become the first president to address the NAACP, the first president to commission a presidential report on civil rights, a really essential figure in the long struggle. President Johnson, same way. November 22nd, 1963, Johnson had been affected by his national election as vice president, and he wanted to be president, so he knew that he had to deal with the Northern liberals. He gave a very interesting speech, I recommend it, on Memorial Day 1963, so about 4 or 5 months before he becomes president, at Gettysburg, where he says, "We keep saying patience. Why would you be patient if your rights were abridged?"
Interesting. John Meacham, our guest, we are talking about our history, talking about our presidents, and we're talking about his new book called The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. And you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and if you're just joining us, John Meacham is our guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer. He's written books about a number of our presidents. He's also a visiting professor at Vanderbilt University, a contributing writer for the New York Times Book Review, a fellow of the Society of American Historians. You see him from time to time on Morning Joe, and he also writes books. He's got a new one, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. Let me just jump into something that you spend a lot in this book, because it covers a lot of the first half and some extra years of the 20th century, a lot talking about the KKK.
Yeah.
We now, of course, know, in fact, you say in this book that it was what happened in Charlottesville that got you thinking about the mm-hmm. soul of America. What do you make of what the KKK represented back then, and how do you see the proponents, supporters today?
Well, there are two clans, at least in scholarly interpretation. There's the first Klan, which came up after the Civil War, was particularly terroristic and vigilante. President Grant did a good job of putting it down. In many ways, the Justice Department grew out of that effort, that enforcement effort. The Klan that I think tells us the most about where we are now is the one that was refounded, created in 1915, Stone Mountain, Georgia, now a Confederate monument, yeah. in which it was a time of great economic transition between agrarian and industrial, a time of enormous immigration, a fear on the part of a white working class that immigrants were going to come in and take their jobs. It was an extraordinary national movement, 3 to 5 million members. Very powerful in almost every state of the Union, Indiana, Oregon, Colorado, Texas and Georgia might not be as surprising, but the other states are. The 1924 Democratic National Convention, there were 347 Klansmen were delegates that forced the convention to 103 ballots to stop Al Smith, an Irish Catholic.
Not wearing hoods.
Not wearing hoods. 50,000 of them marched down Pennsylvania Avenue in 1925. Hugo Black, future Supreme Court justice, was a member. The only reason Truman didn't join is because he liked Catholics.
And the Klan never liked Catholics.
Right, right. So what happened? The Supreme Court made two important decisions, anti-Klan decisions. Harding and Coolidge did the right thing. Immigration was restricted in 1924 and stayed restricted for 41 years until 1965. So that, to me, that's where the most resonance is.
You also say the Klan sabotaged itself, that it also it did things to undo itself, essentially.
It's a gothic, macabre story. The Grand Wizard or whatever tortured a woman. It was horrible stuff. And so that undercut the Klan. Yeah. So there was self-destruction and these broader social forces. And just in time, because had the Klan survived until the early – there's a lot of good scholarship on this – survived into the early 1930s, that had a kind of Germanic feel. If you'd had millions of people organized and ready, then in the crisis of capitalism, in the crisis of the constitutional order in 1932-33 – FDR might have had an even harder time preserving the system against right-wing forces.
Well, we have neo-Nazis today. We have people who say they are a member of a Klan or some of these extremist groups. You got Alex Jones, saying that what happened at Sandy Hook was a bunch of actors pretending to die as children were mowed down in their classroom.
And all of that is part of a persistent, deeply, deeply tragic strain in the American character that Richard Hofstadter, the Columbia historian, called the paranoid style in American politics. And one of the things I try to do here, one of the reasons I do what I do, is let's not just let the past be instructive afterward. So look at the events leading up to President Kennedy's assassination, November 22nd, 1963. When we tell that story now, we talk about how Lady Bird Johnson was spit on by right-wing extremists in Dallas a couple of years before. Adlai Stevenson, the ambassador of the United Nations, was nearly attacked by John Birch Society, right-wing anti-communists in Dallas. When we look back on this now, we say, oh, well, you could see this line leading to the cataclysm. But that's only retrospective. My goal here is – like the conspiracy theorists you're talking about, like the madness about guns right now and the mindless defense of some absolute right to any kind of military-style weapon, you know, what we have to try to do is in real time realize that what reform is necessary and why do we always have to wait? And the gun issue is a great question because we're way beyond this point. Why does it have to be only after the worst possible thing? And
when we look back and say, well, if only.
Right. And there's believe me, on the gun issue, there is no if only. It's already happened. There's the blood of children who and I so admire these students in Parkland, Florida, who may end up being the Diane Nash and the John Lewis mm-hmm. and the James Foreman of the movement to have a sensible policy on these horrible military-style weapons which have no sporting purpose whatever.
Let me get – it looks like Sabine from Westchester, Pennsylvania, to join our conversation. Sabine, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
So I have a question relating to civil rights and the Supreme Court. So I know that over time there have been a number of Supreme Court cases that have talked about civil rights and citizenship. I think one of the first main ones that really got a lot of attention was Dred Scott versus Stanford and talking about the fact that former slaves could not be taken and could not be made free or made citizens. Mm-hmm. And it's furthered with different versions throughout our history, whether it was with Native Americans or women or Chinese immigrants or the Japanese during World War II with Japanese internment.
Sure.
And eventually going back to the earlier conversation with Johnson and the civil rights movement and being able to break up segregation. I was wondering if you could speak to how that evolution has occurred and if given the situation today with the immigration and the borders, sure. if how President Trump and our climate today is moving and what direction you think we might be going in.
Save mine. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. John Meacham, go ahead.
Great question. You know, the 14th Amendment is the critical piece of this. The 14th Amendment really overturned Dred Scott. It established the principle of birthright citizenship, made African-Americans former slaves citizens. Andrew Johnson, who we mentioned a moment ago, opposed the 14th Amendment, which is worth noting. My own sense is that there needs to be a legislative solution as opposed to a court one. Maybe there's a court decision that helps lead to that. But the fact that – and my own view of this, and this is a purely personal opinion, is that the immigration issue has been demagogued beyond recognition to some extent. And so in my view, this is not a hope that is based on much, but if the incumbent president wants to be remembered as a great man, and he does, that's the issue to go to China on. What do we remember about Richard Nixon? That he went to China after being an anti-communist. What do we remember about Ronald Reagan? That he made peace with the Soviet Union after being a cold warrior. What do we remember about George Herbert Walker Bush? He raised taxes because he thought it was responsible after saying he never would. I don't have any hope this is going to happen. I have some hope because we always have hope. But what Trump should do is decide that there's going to be a coherent plan, not unlike the ones that were negotiated but never successfully passed during 43's administration, and actually come up with a coherent immigration policy as opposed to this mindlessly populist, demagogic talk about the border. And that's where it seems to me some administration in the future, some Congress in the future is going to get there. What I would urge the people in the Congress now and the president, if I had 2 minutes with him, would be why not make that a legacy achievement?
Hmm. Kind of what Ronald Reagan did back in the 1980s when it came to immigration?
Well, yeah. Well, President Reagan, you look at him now and he looks like, you know, a figure out of the Brookings Institution, and which tells you something. But the presidents we remember, the eras we remember fondly, are those that reached beyond their base, that actually built on hope and not fear. And this is not a Sunday sermon. This is not a 4th of July homily. It's simply the fact. Mm. The things what is the one thing Dwight Eisenhower said that you remember? He warned against
the military-industrial complex.
All right, so a 5-star general, the conqueror of Hitler, the Cold War president, warns against something that you would think he would have been the embodiment of. Nixon and China, Johnson, as you said, Johnson and Truman, two Confederate-based senators, are remembered for their work on civil rights. Hmm. Why the – I sound a little frustrated here. But why the president and those around him don't understand this is a perpetual puzzlement to me, because it doesn't take much to figure out that if you want to win in the long term – because I'm not saying just do it because it's the right thing, because I've given that up. But if you want to – people to look at your portrait and think, you know what, he was a son of a bitch, but that son of a bitch did X and Y. You got to get to the X and Y part. Right now, he's just the son of a bitch.
But it seems that we have a president who denigrates our allies. he's in Europe. He seems to be very attracted to authoritarian leaders. He's going to be meeting with Putin. We know what he said about Duterte and some other leaders as well. So it seems that authoritarian people don't – I mean, people who have those authoritarian impulses don't think the way you do, John.
No, I know. And there's a reason I do what I do and no one would vote for me. I get it. I'm not saying this is going to happen in 72 hours. But all I can do is tell you what I've learned from looking back, and what I've learned is that the presidents we remember are the ones who surprise us.
You say in your book, and near the end, it's important to vote and pay attention and to – be aware of the dangers of tribalism. And one of our listeners says, I appreciate your ideas. The first duty of an American citizen is to particularly resist tribalism. I'm committing right here and now to have lunch with an acquaintance who is in the other party so I can begin to understand how many of my fellow Americans feel as I do or as they do.
The revolution begins.
One email at a time, right?
But you know what? Eleanor Roosevelt, I quote her in the book saying this. She says, do that. Go to the other guy's meetings. We all know in our own lives that it's easier to demonize people we aren't looking at. How much easier is it to write a mean comment than it is to say it to someone? Ask the president who can't seem to do that, right? He attacks
people. That's why Twitter exists,
right,
isn't it?
Right. And my lecture to my children is never write, and I try to do this. I think I do it mostly. Never write anything online that you wouldn't say to the person to their face. And if so, that will reduce your traffic significantly.
Right.
And That's absolutely so. Good for the commenter.
We've actually two people who have references to climate change. One saying that they worry so much about climate change that is going to undo us. Yeah. Do you see it that way?
I do. Al Gore's a friend. We're neighbors in Nashville. I think Al is right. I think he's been right for a long time. It's a compelling case. I recommend all of his work on this issue. It is a national security question. It's an imperial influence question. It's a human nature question. Absolutely. It requires the kind of patient political leadership that is not going to happen with the incumbent. But I believe if I'm right that these things move in cycles, I hope that the next person has a coherent and explicable plan to begin to address it, more than begin to address it, to address it.
I want to shift gears and talk about Barbara Bush, who died. And you gave a really beautiful eulogy to her and to the kind of woman that you got to know, I guess, when you were writing a book about her husband.
Yeah, Mrs. Bush is – I still use the present tense because I'm sure she's listening.
a formidable woman, yes.
Oh, my God. She'd be saying, all right, cut it short.
Yeah, right.
No, she was amazing. And represents – she's not perfect and her husband's not perfect and her son's not perfect. This is not overly sentimental. But in real time, the senior Bushes gave of themselves in the sense that – yes, they wanted to be in the White House. Yes, they wanted to be at the pinnacle of power. But at every point in their pursuit of power, the Bushes then put the country first. President Bush opposed the 1964 Civil Rights Act, but then he voted for fair housing when he was actually in office. He ran a ferocious campaign, in many ways an unattractive campaign, against Michael Dukakis. But the moment he became president, he governed with a kind of congeniality and spirit of compromise that's genuinely unimaginable today. I remember talking to President Obama about Bush and Senior, and he said, can you imagine a Republican president signing the Americans with Disabilities Act? Hmm. It's just not – it doesn't compute anymore. And he made that famous pledge about taxes and then raised them, knowing that he would lose, knowing that he, as he put in his diary, I'm going to be dead meat. And Mrs. Bush said the same thing in her diary. My favorite – quick story is years ago.
It's going to have to be really quick.
Really quick.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was mistaken for John Grisham once, and I told the story to Mrs. Bush. I said, you know, somebody thought I was John Grisham, and she looked at me and said, and I was expecting some motherly reassurance. She said, well, how do you think poor John Grisham would feel? You know, he's a very handsome man. So that's Barbara Pierce Bush.
Well, that seems like the perfect place to end our conversation. John Meacham, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. And the book is called The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out more about the program. You can download podcasts of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. We took some pictures of our guests. You can also sign up for our newsletter, which you get Sunday morning at noon. Bob Ball is the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.